thank you for joining us on The Skeptic Sidekick, where we delve into ancient societies, the ghosts, the paranormal, UFOs, all looking at it from the perspective of the true believer and from the skeptic perspective. Joining me, my partner, my co-host, my sibling, Kimber Rodriguez. Myself, I am Richard Gregg. And again, let's look into being the skeptic psychic. Hi! Thanks once again for coming to this wonderful, wonderful edition of the Skeptic Sidekick. And with me today, as always, such a wonderful thrill, honor, prestige, and greatest thing in the whole wide world, next to my wife, my sister, my co-partner, the really cool, intelligent person in the family, Kimber Rodriguez.
Hey, how's it going?
Oh, pretty well. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm doing fairly good. This is being recorded on the 11th of December. So yesterday I found out afternoon that one of my favorite songwriters, composers, musician, awesome type of person, the man who literally created MTV and sold the rights to that, Mr. Michael, heir to the whiteout throne, Nesmith.
Yeah, the biggest mistake he ever made was selling MTV.
Yeah, well.
And it became more of RTV than MTV.
Yeah. Cover your ears, boys and girls, because we're going to get ready to rumble. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, here we go. We're going to talk about Antichrist, a.k.a. Harry Houdini, illusionist, magician, stunt performer, and all-around movie man. And versus in the other corner, the legendary father of Sherlock Holmes, Sir Arthur, Conan Doyle, and the Chronicles One. Yes, we're going to be talking about the spiritual awakenings of Harry Houdini and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Yes, tonight is the skeptic versus the spiritualist is what we are discussing tonight.
Yes, so what can you tell me about Sir Arthur Conan Doyle?
He is most known as the inventor of Sherlock Holmes, but he's had a varied career as a writer, journalist, and a public figure. He was born on May 22nd of 1859 in Edinburgh into a prosperous Irish family.
Interesting to note the fact that he was born in Edinburgh, Scotland, but he was an Irish family.
I was just thinking that.
Yes.
He also trained to be a doctor and got his degree with the Edinburgh University in 1881. And he worked as a surgeon on a whaling boat. He was also a medical officer on a steamer traveling between Liverpool and West Africa. After that, he settled in Portsmouth on the English South Coast. At that time, he divided his time between medicine and writing. In 1887, Sherlock Holmes made his first appearance in A Study of Scarlet, and this was published in the Beaton's Christmas Annual. Due to its success, Conan was encouraged to write more stories involving Holmes. However, in 1893, Conan killed off Holmes, and he was hoping to concentrate on more serious writing. However, a public outcry later made him resurrect Holmes. He also wrote a number of other novels, including The Lost World and various nonfiction works. With these nonfiction works included is a pamphlet that justifies Britain's involvement in the Boer War. At that time, he was knighted and his histories of the Boer War and World War I, in which his son, brother, and two of his nephews were killed. He also twice tried to run for parliament, but failed. And as we're going to talk about in just a bit, his life later became very interested in the spiritualism and the spiritual movement. He died of a heart attack on July 7th of 1930. So why don't we jump over and learn a little bit about Houdini and his life?
Well, let's talk a little bit about the birth of young Erik Weisz, that is spelled W-E-I-S-Z, who was born in Budapest, Hungary, in March 24th, 1874. His family, I believe in 1881, migrated over to America to find a better life. Now, when Harry was maybe about 9 or 10 years old, he and his brother, Theodore, ran away from home to actually try to become famous illusionists, and quickly were brought back home again about a few months later by their father, who was a very strict disciplinarian. He later changed his name to Harry Houdini after his favorite magician, Robert Houdin. He's been known as an escape artist, an illusionist, stunt performer, a movie star of all things. Surprisingly, he made 5 movies from his own movie studio. He was known to attract a crowd by escaping from a straitjacket and handcuffs high atop of a crane while he was standing on his head type thing. He married his wife Bess in 1894, and the real controversy is the fact that while he was a great magician, performer, type sort of situation, he was very animate and very indifferent. In fact, went to the U.S. Congress to actually try to ban spiritualism as it being a destructive tool. It went so far as to try to pass a law in Washington, D.C. that fortune tellers would be banned from the city steps. He died October 31st, 1926, in what the doctor has described as a ruptured appendicitis. That is pretty much the life and death of Harry Handcuff, the man, the mission, Houdini.
Interesting. So the films that he made, those were silent films? This was before the talkies?
Yes, before the talkies.
So, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was raised Catholic, and even though he was raised in that tradition, he began to question his beliefs, so he started to call himself agnostic. So strong were his beliefs that he refused to help his father's family in establishing their medical practice, because he realized that the family would recommend him to church connections, and he felt that it would be hypocritical to draw on that sort of support. However, as early as 1881, he started to show an interest in spiritualism. During that year, he attended a lecture on spiritualism, and in 1887, The Light, which was a spiritualistic magazine, published an article by Doyle describing a seance that he had attended. In 1889, he attended a lecture on mesmerism, which was given by Professor Milo de Meyer. In fact, as part of the lecture, de Meyer tried to mesmerize or hypnotize Conan Doyle, but he failed. So in 1883, Conan Doyle joined the British Society for Psychical Research. Other members were the future Prime Minister Arthur Balfour, the philosopher William James, the naturalist Alfred Russel Wallace, and scientists William Crookes and Oliver Lodge. In 1849, Colonel Elmer asked the organization to investigate mysterious sounds that were coming from his home in Dorset. At night, Elmore and his wife and his adult daughter could hear chains being dragged across wooden floors and moaning that sounded like the soul it was in torment. His dog refused to enter certain parts of the home, and most of his staff had left. Conan Doyle and Dr. Sidney Scott and Frank Podmore were sent to investigate if there was a haunting. They spent several evenings in the home. However, their results were inconclusive. One night, the investigators were disturbed by some fearsome uproar, but there was no damage or cause of the noise that could be discovered. Conan Doyle left the Dorset home and was unsure if it was genuinely haunted or if it had been a hoax. Later, the body of a child, approximately 10 years old, was discovered buried in the garden. And he became convinced that he really had witnessed a psychic phenomenon, and that was caused by the spirit of the dead child. Okay, I can understand there being a ghost of a dead child that was buried in the yard, but why the chains and the moaning? And I mean, that goes back to reminds me of, you know, the Christmas Carol and Jacob Marley. I'm not Jacob Marley. You know which one I mean. The spirit that came to Scrooge and the chains. And I mean, do they think that all ghosts carry?
That was Jacob Marley.
Oh, was Jacob Marley? Okay, I thought so.
Yes, Jacob Marley.
So do they just think that these ghosts in the afterlife were just handed over a bunch of chains that we have to carry around for all eternity? I mean, why the chains?
Oh, yeah, the less chains you have. Yes.
It makes no sense.
You know, interesting to note that spiritualism roots lay in the 1840s New York. Specifically, with the Hydeville home was the first, you know, official paranormal activity of the Fox sisters, who were later revealed the fact that they were cracking their toe knuckles to fool their mother and neighbors that the disembodied raps were from the otherworld messages. Next few decades, the movement had gained traction, attracting followers all the way up to, you know, the 1860s, when after the devastation of the Civil War, First Lady Mary Lincoln held seances in the White House to console herself following the death of second youngest son, Willie, from a typhoid fever, and also consulted soothsayers. Marcia Chatney, whose livelihood was threatened by the proposal of 1920s legislation, proposed by Harry Houdini, who boasted that both Edith Wilson, wife of President Woodrow, and Florence Harding, wife of President Harding, as being her clients. Along this time, that on the American side, after, you know, English physicist Oliver Lodge did work the radio, on our side of the pond, Thomas Alvin Edison and Alexander Graham Bell similarly experimented with tools for spirit transmission. In 1920, Mr. Houdini befriended one of the most ardent supporters, aka Conan Doyle. He was dubbed during that time as the St. Paul of spiritualism in the writer's company. Houdini had just lost his mother in 1913 and was actually trying to contact his long, sweet, dear departed mother. However, the more he got into talking to these psychics, these astrologers, these clairvoyants, he began to notice a pattern that the stuff that he was doing on stage in front of thousands and thousands of people, millions per year, were the same tricks that these psychics were doing. I mean, with tapping on walls, he actually did studies into spiritual photography, which basically you took a picture and whatever popped up in there was supposed to have been a ghost. He's got to celebrate one of him with Abraham Lincoln. Houdini actually went to a spiritual medium held by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's wife, Jean, who said she was a medium and believed in doing automatic writing, scribbled a 5-page message supposedly from Houdini's dearly departed mother. On each page was drawn a cross. However, sorry to say, young, sweet, innocent Eric Weiss was Jewish. And his mother was Jewish. So to actually see the cross on top of each page, and in English, of all things, he really kind of burned his bridges with a friendship with Conan Doyle. They'd actually have a Cold War in the press during lecture tours and even before Congress, where Harry Houdini's opinion of Sir Arthur was that he was one of the greatest dupes is preserved in a hearing transcript.
Well, it could be that even though his mother was Jewish, maybe she found something else on the other side. I mean, you never know.
Yes, but it was in English. His mother never spoke English.
Well, she could have learned it on the other side. I mean,
mm-hmm.
There's no time and space on the other side. She could have, you know, met up with some English-speaking spirit and they got to know each other and taught her English. You never know.
Right.
Really quick, going back to Lincoln and there in Mary Todd's involvement in the spiritualists. If I remember correctly, didn't she have like prophetic dreams or intuition in her life, including a bad feeling she had about the night that they went to the theater that she didn't want him to go?
Yes, she actually tried to feign a headache.
Yeah, that would be an interesting topic that I'd like to discuss on a future episode if people are interested.
Right.
About Mary Todd and her intuition and how she could have saved Lincoln's life. Anyway. Back to Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. We're going to jump back a little bit to October of 1917 when Doyle gave his first public lecture on spiritualism. He wanted to present the facts as he knew them for the benefit of mankind. Even though he knew his reputation and his career would suffer, he became an outspoken proponent for the movement. He wrote books, articles, and made countless public appearances to promote his public beliefs. Really quick, they're mowing my yard outside. Is it too loud or is it bothering?
I haven't heard a thing.
Okay, good. I just want to make sure it's not overpowering my voice.
Oh, there he goes. I hear it now.
Okay. I'll try to speak a little louder. Even though he knew his reputation and career would suffer, he became an outspoken proponent. He wrote books, articles, and made countless appearances to promote his beliefs. His easygoing manner and absolute faith in the movement made him effective as a speaker. He was so sincere that even opponents of the spiritualism considered him to be well-intentioned. So that was one thing interesting about him is, you know, because he was such a good person and kind-hearted that even the skeptics were like, well, you know, he may be talking false stuff, but he's not doing it to scam people. He really believes in this stuff and he's, you know, his intentions are good is what the skeptics were thinking about him.
Well, yeah. Even Harry Houdini said that, yeah, he's a good guy, but I think he's being led down the wrong path. And the quote is that Arthur Conan Doyle is one of the greatest dupes.
Yes. A skeptic named Harry Price made a reputation for himself by exposing fake mediums. And about Conan Doyle, he said, setting aside for the moment his extraordinary and most lovable personal qualities, the chief qualification that he possessed for the role of the investigator was his crusading zeal. Among all the notable persons attracted to spiritualism, he was perhaps the most uncritical. His extreme credulity. No, it's C-R-E-D-U-L-I-T-Y. Credulity.
Credibility.
Indeed. No, it's not credibility. It's credulity.
Credulity. Okay.
Indeed, was the despair of his colleagues, all of whom, however, held him in the highest respect for his complete honesty. Poor, dear, lovable, credulous Doyle. He was a giant in stature with the heart of a child. Gee, that's a little condescending, wouldn't you say?
I would say it's very condescending.
Yes.
You know, in 1924, at the behest of Conan Doyle, Scientific America offered a $25,000 prize to any medium who could produce physical manifestations of spirit communications under stringent test conditions. Scientific America was, you know, it's one of the 60 minutes of their time. Investigating journalists, including psychologists, physicians, mathematicians from Harvard's MIT and other institutions. After dismissing several contestants, the committee focused attention on the upper-class Boston medium, Marjorie Crandon, the wife of a Harvard-trained doctor. Her performance of a deception suggests a magician's talent rivaling Houdini. While subject in a trance, in which Houdini was there as one of the guest judges, her hands controlled by others, Crandon channeled a spirit that reportedly whispered in the ears of seance sitters, pinched them, poked them, pulled their hair, floated roses on their nose, even moved objects and furniture about the room.
Only thing with skeptics, and I know Peter, I'm not Peter James, who's the famous skeptic of our time? James Randi.
James Randi has gone, and Penn Jillette has actually taken up the cause.
I don't know if Penn Jillette has taken this up, but James Randi, when he was alive, I know he did have a $1 million prize for anybody who could prove the existence of the spiritualism, whether it be ghosts, yeah, psychics. But my theory is nobody will ever win that prize, because when you're a skeptic, no matter what amount of evidence is handed to you, you're always going to come up with some excuse to make it fake. Jesus Christ could come down and stand right in front of them and say, I am, you know, the Son of God, your Savior. And they would be like, okay, I'm having a temporary psychosis, or, you know, they'll come up with something.
I'm having a temporary psychosis, exponent upon hallucinations, that sort of thing. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, definitely. They will never take any evidence as proof. And I have heard some of the lamest excuses trying to disprove something is true. And it's crazy. But then on the other hand, you do have the people who are so dead set in believing that they'll take anything as evidence, whether it is or not.
Right.
I mean, it's good to be a little skeptic.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't believe that every bump in the night is a ghost.
Every bump in the night does not mean a ghost. However, a consistent notice of the fact that the bump is happening at specific time, place, or location. You know, if you can recreate the bump, say at 12:30 at night, then it's false.
Right.
But if you turn around, it's like, okay, everybody's sitting with their feet off the ground. It's 12:30 at night. And there's a bump. Okay, well, was there a bump earlier? Let's try 1:30. Is there a bump? Is there trees? You know.
Right. You need to definitely look for what could be a reasonable cause of whatever's happening. I definitely believe that it's good to have not only the healthy skepticism, but the healthy belief as well. I think they go hand in hand. Interestingly, in the late 1920s, Conan's reputation hit a new low. The December issue of the Strand magazine featured an article that was written by Doyle about some extraordinary photos. There were two young ladies in Yorkshire village of Cottingley that took photographs of things they'd seen around their country home. It was believed that these things in these photos were fairies. Conan Doyle learned of the photos earlier in the year, and he began to investigate the matter. He sent negatives of the photographs in to be testing at two different places. One group was the London representatives of Kodak, and they stated that no one had tampered with the negatives. They also said that they could produce similar photos, and therefore they could not state if the photos were genuine or not of the fairies. He received a different response from the second expert, which was Harold Snelling. He examined the negatives and declared the photos were genuine. His endorsement, along with Conan Doyle's chivalrous view that the two young ladies would not lie about such a matter, led him to believe that the photos were authentic photos of fairies. Now, what are your thoughts on that and the possibility as that fairies showed up in photos in a small area of London, or England, I should say?
I would say that basically they look like cardboard cutouts even to this day. I'm sorry. It's just that it's kind of seemed like they were more Victorian, late 19th century, early 20th century from a children's book illustrations.
No, I definitely agree. And I'll post a link to the image so that our viewers can check it out. To me, I would think a photo of fairies would possibly be maybe like little lights fluttering around. Like, I don't know. But those could also be bugs. So, I mean, you never really know. It could be bugs. It could be fairies. But I do definitely believe that the photo is, as you said, maybe something from a children's book, an illustration. But I will go ahead and post that for our viewers. Anything else you would like to add about Houdini?
Well, again, like I said, just going into the fact of, you know, that he did go to Congress, even showed them how possibly they could be, you know, done. And of course, you know, Congress kind of like, oh, yeah, you know, they finally kind of said live and let live type of situation. But with Harry Houdini, his death is kind of clouded in mystery because a month before he died, his famous water trick, he accidentally broke his ankle trying to escape from that.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah. And a few weeks later, he was actually, you know, performing, and these college students showed up, you know, and they're talking to him, laughing and joking. And one of them turns around, starts hitting him really hard into his stomach, and he doubled over.
My gosh.
And the guy's like, what? You know, I thought you could take it. And he's kind of laughed off. It's okay. It's okay. It's okay. Went on to stage, perform, got off stage, and was complaining about the fact his abdominal was inflamed. It was hurt. Went to a doctor, and doctor's like, you know, look, we're going to have to operate on this. And he's like, no, I think, you know, I'll just take some stuff. Give me about a week. And within that week, the doctor's report was that he died of peritonitis, which is an inflammation of the membrane that lines the abdominal wall, then folds into and closes the abdomen organs.
I thought you had said earlier that it was appendicitis.
When you have appendicitis attack, that's the reason why they're worried about the fact of periodontitis. It may be an periodontitis, maybe an acute or chronic generalization or localization caused by inflammation elsewhere in the body, and may be due to a number of causes, such as a bacterial invasion from affected structure, blood, or other fluids from a ruptured organ. Perforated gastrointestinal intestinal tract, notably a ruptured appendix.
Ah, okay. I gotcha.
Interesting to note, the day he died was October 31st of 1926.
Yes. Do you think that he already had this? Maybe he already had some kind of issue, and then when the guy punched him in the stomach, it aggravated the issue, causing the rupture? Or do you think that he was okay, and then when the guy hit him, he hit him so hard that it created this?
Harry Houdini already had a problem with having a lot of ulcers throughout his life. So to me, I think that if he didn't get himself seen pretty soon, I think that it was already going to happen, but the guy kind of pushed it along forwardly.
Kind of acerbated it.
Yes, exactly.
Interesting.
And he actually went to trial and they found him not guilty.
Oh, wow. I mean, it's kind of sad that they, you know, prosecute. Well, I mean, if you think about it, who actually goes up and just punches somebody just for the hell of it?
Well, Harry Houdini had always stated, because of his how much control over his muscles, that he could actually, you know, flex his abs so much that it was tightened to where you could just punch him and it wouldn't hurt. But give him time, he'd get that set up. But the guy just kind of turned around and punched him, not once, not twice, three times into the stomach.
Yeah, I mean, who does that?
Young, stupid college kids.
Yes. Unfortunately, they haven't gotten any brighter as time has gone on.
But yeah, it's just interesting to note that, as one person said it, I believe the gentleman's name was Nikhil. Don't know his first name, but he says that you can't miss the irony of this world-famous magician dying on Halloween and this gimmick of seeing if you can contact his spirit, which, you know, he knew couldn't be done. It was all of a part of a thing to make a point, the Houdini no-show. He was always going to be a no-show. Unless, Nikhil added, somebody was fiddling with the evidence. Let that sink in.
It's really interesting. I mean, I've seen photos and different things of seances back in the day, and you can definitely tell the fakery in them. Not that all seances are fake, because I know I've participated in one that things happened that could not be explained. I know I was there. But at the same time, and again, I've seen other seances take place that are very interesting. But I don't know if the spiritualism, the whole point of it was to dupe people, or if they were so desperate to prove their point that they had to commit fakery or do these false things to get people to believe them. But I really think it did put a dent into the whole spiritual realm. I think that it tarnished and damaged the whole movement by this fakery. What are your thoughts on that?
Again, like the fakery during that time, one of the spiritualists, Mr. Coates, says, "My religion goes back to Jesus Christ. Houdini does not know I'm a Christian." To which Houdini responded, "Jesus was a Jew, and he did not charge $2 a visit."
Well, this is true. But you got to look at it like, this is these people's livelihood. This is these people's jobs. Not that they aren't wanting to help people, but you got to make a living, especially in this day and age. You've got to pay bills. You've got to...
But most of the psychics and spiritualist influencers, they weren't charging $2 an hour. They were charging thousands upon thousands of dollars just to sit with the rich and famous and tell them everything. So to me, there may have been some authentic psychics, that sort of thing. However, it was like they were milking the grieving. I mean, today we do have psychics and mediums, that sort of thing out there who do kind of make a living. But at the same time, they don't try to flaunt it, I should say, as much as they did during the early part of the 20th century and the full reign of the spiritualist movement.
This is true. I mean, yes, there are psychics who do charge a bit of money, but these are the ones who, basically, you're going to them for their name. These are the people who are, you know, on TV or, you know, celebrities. And even not all of them charge a lot of money. I know I've seen like Chip Coffey has promoted his readings on his Facebook page. And I mean, they are, well, I wouldn't say they're pricey. I mean, some people might think, oh my gosh, you charge that much. But compared to other people I've seen, I think his prices are very reasonable. But I mean, you're getting into the celebrity psychics at that point when you're looking at like Chip Coffey or Chris Fleming or, you know, any of them. Those are celebrities. But if you just want to go to a regular psychic down the street and get your cards read or tell your fortune, they're not going to charge you that much.
No. But like I said, the people that Harry Houdini were going after were the ones that were charging exorbitant amounts, and $2 back during the time that Harry Houdini was going around was pretty expensive. That was like 2 days' wages. I mean, we're talking about you go to the movie, it was a dime. Go to a restaurant, it was like 75 cents.
Looking up $2 in 1900 versus today would be about $66.18 today.
Yes.
Per person. So, yeah. I mean, by today's standards, $66, I guess, is not bad. But like you said, for that day and age, it was more so. People didn't make money the way we do today. So, yeah.
I mean, again, like I said, this show is called The Skeptic Sidekick. And we will allow everyone to show us, you know, their wonderful tools and that sort of thing. And it's wonderful. I think it's wonderful. But at the same time, we've got to understand that where the history is and where it's going.
Yes. Just a little bit more on Conan Doyle. Conan Doyle's support of the spiritual movement did damage his reputation as he knew it would. However, he was never one to back down from a fight. And he was never one to back down from the fight of the spiritualism. And this was one that he fought until the end. If that makes any sense. Sorry, my words are all over the place. But he did fight for the spiritual movement up until his death. And a few days before his death in 1930 of a heart attack, he wrote, "The reader will judge that I have had many adventures. The greatest and most glorious of all awaits me now." So to me, it sounds kind of like he knew he was getting ready to pass. And he was ready for that adventure and that journey to see if there really was an afterlife. On Houdini's side, I know after his death for several years, I don't know if it's still participated in, but I know for several years on the anniversary of his death, his family would hold a seance, because I remember something about him saying that if there was an afterlife, he would come back to let everyone know. So they would hold a seance on the anniversary of his death every year to see if he would come back. And I think the last time I remember hearing about it was maybe 2000, somewhere around there. And at that point, he still hadn't returned.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any updates on that or any information on that?
They stopped it about a few years ago.
And he never returned, did he?
No.
That's very interesting. But it goes back to what you said in a previous episode when we talked with Patty Negri about what you believe in this life is what you get in that life. And you referred to my favorite book by Pierce Anthony, On a Pale Horse.
Mm-hmm.
And about the atheist who, when death took his soul, it crumbled into dust. So who knows? Maybe that's the way it is. Whatever we believe in this life is what we get in the next life. So if Houdini didn't believe in an afterlife, maybe he didn't get an afterlife. I don't know. What do you think?
Kind of think that as well. You know, his belief is what he became.
Or do you think he chose not to return because he didn't want to? Basically, he didn't want everybody to know that he was wrong. So he chose not to come back.
Well, I remember back, it was a comedy show, they would do these certain 30-second sketches, what so-and-so was doing right this moment. And they had a Halloween episode, and they flashed up on screen, what Harry Houdini is doing right this moment. And they had one of the comedians on the show dressed like Houdini, surrounded by beautiful bikini-clad women. And one of the girls looks down and says, weren't you supposed to be back on October 31st? And he's like, yeah, screw it.
I believe it. I do think he is up there. I just don't think he wants to be proven wrong.
Right.
So that's why he's never come back. Because he's like, if I come back, then that just blows everything out of the water that I've said throughout my life and fought for. So why am I going to prove myself wrong?
Right.
Ruin my own reputation.
So I can't remember what the name of the show was, but.
Yes, I'll have to see if I can find that.
Hold on a second.
Okay.
One of the actresses on the show was Julie Brown, and was on Fox.
Mad TV?
No, it wasn't Mad TV. The Edge.
The Edge?
Yes.
Okay. I'll see if I can find that and post the link to that for our viewers so they can check that out.
Yeah. It also had Jennifer Aniston and Wayne Knight on it.
Interesting. I'll have to check that out. Well, this has been a very interesting conversation about spiritualism, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and Harry Houdini. Any final thoughts on the matter?
Final thoughts. Harry Houdini was a sacred believer. He was looking for a way to reach out and hear from his mother. And towards the end of his life, he was becoming pretty disillusioned with everything going on because all he was seeing was the same magic tricks that he was doing on stage for thousands of people. And it really bummed him out, really hurt his feelings that, you know, the things that he did to entertain these people were making money off of and not doing any explanation type situation. I wouldn't say he was jealous.
Right. No, I wouldn't say that either. But I think it was more, like you said, disillusioned. Because the one thing he wanted was to believe. He wanted to reconnect with his dead mother, who he loved dearly. And on Doyle's side, Conan Doyle's side, I don't think he was a dupe for believing. I don't think he was naive or an idiot. I think it's very commendable of him that, you know, despite the fact that there were those out there who were trying to scam people, he was trying to prove that not everything is a scam, that there is more to this life than what we see, what we hear on our own level. And I mean, I really commend him for that. I wish he could have aligned himself with better role models. No, not necessarily colleagues, I guess would be a better word than role models. Better colleagues to prove his beliefs and his points.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, you know, like I said, that was a time that was very tarnishing on the paranormal field, but I think we've come a long way since then. And I think that the people that we have who represent the paranormal now, they're more scientific. They are better at looking for answers. Of course, there's still going to be scammers out there. Unfortunately, anytime you get, I mean, look at it, there's scammers in the church, there's scammers in big business. I mean, there's always going to be somebody out there who's going to take somebody else. You just have to be smart about it and, you know, not believe, like we said before, don't believe everything you see and hear. But I definitely hope we are closer to finding actual proof. I mean, Einstein was a believer in the paranormal. I mean, Einstein believes that everything is made up of energy and energy is everlasting. So if we ourselves are made up of energy, then we would continue on after our bodies are gone. And I think that that's something that a lot of skeptics that I've heard, it's all like, well, it's not, you know, it goes against science to believe in the paranormal and this and that. But if we're energy, that coincides right along with science. And so I think that we need to step back and look at that more and challenge that more on the fact that we are all energy. And I think if we were to look into that more, then we would get closer to proving there is another world beyond this veil. What are your thoughts?
Yeah. I do believe there is a world beyond this veil. I do also believe that things that are within the unexplained. So,
yes. And with that thought, again, we ask all of our listeners to please follow us on Apple Podcasts or Google or Podchaser or Spotify. If you follow us on Apple, please rate us and review us. The reviews do help making it easier for our show to be found. We do read reviews on the show. A good review, a bad review, you know, there's always room for improvement.
Yes. You tell us we suck, we'll read it on air saying we suck.
And we now are posting videos of our show on YouTube. So we ask our listeners to become viewers by checking us out where you can see our beautiful faces on YouTube.
Sure. You say beautiful faces. I'm, you know, your beautiful face, but mine, you know.
Oh, come on. We look alike. We're brother and sister. If I'm beautiful, you are.
That's not saying much, Kim. Come on.
Gee, thanks. But anyway, make sure you head over to YouTube and check out our videos and like and subscribe there. Ring the bell to get notifications. Comment below. Share with your friends.
All righty. And you have yourself a very unpleasant nightmare. Good night.
Pleasant dreams. Take care, everybody. Bye.